From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Another marker in the deterioration of relations between the U.S. and Russia, with a test by the U.S. this past weekend of a new ground-based cruise missile capable of covering 500 kilometers in range, less than 3 weeks after officially exiting a treaty that banned such systems. The U.S. had announced it would exit the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, or INF, late last year. That happened formally on August 2nd. What does it mean? For more on that, we spoke with our geopolitical expert, Mark Sloboda, based in Moscow, via Skype on Tuesday.
This is an interesting story, and it's quite interesting how little coverage this is getting in the U.S. I did a quick search for this story before coming on, and neither the Washington Post nor the New York Times have a story about this U.S. missile test.
Wow.
Yesterday. The Guardian in the U.K. also didn't do a story on it, but although they did republish the AFP's story, which is remarkably sparse and leaves out quite a few details, needless to say.
Right.
So the U.S. tested a land-based Tomahawk cruise missile yesterday off the coast on an island off the coast of California. And this missile would have been in violation of the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty if the U.S. hadn't already unilaterally pulled out of that treaty. The fact that the U.S. unilaterally pulled out of that treaty less than a month ago and is already testing this missile tells you it's quite obvious that they couldn't arrange all of this within just 1 month.
Right.
That they already had this missile on hand. That it just the development of this missile itself, which they obviously had, was in violation. It was already in violation of the INF treaty.
Right.
Now, the more interesting, of course, the fact that they're testing it off the coast of California, to me, is also a symbol that this thing is destined for the Pacific.
Right.
And use in what the U.S., the Pentagon brass and geopolitical thinkers regard as an inevitable war to contain China in the Western Pacific, in the South China Sea, Taiwan Straits area, and they want land-based cruise missiles for Guam, for southern Japan, and elsewhere to buffer up their numbers of missile systems
right.
beyond what they already have for sea and air because of the intermediate range missile advantage that China would have in such a conflict. It would, of course, be right off their coast.
Yeah, so, I mean, the original treaty covered 500 to 5,500 kilometers,
yes.
or 310 to 3,400 miles, roughly. And they say in the press release that this missile hit its target after more than 500 kilometers
yeah,
or 350
yeah,
miles
no specifics,
of flight.
It just said
right.
more than 500.
So what we're talking about here is something that would, you know, be up close, but even if they deployed it, obviously in the Pacific, it would reach all of China. If you know something operating in the INF range, even if they brought them to the west coast of, to the western boundaries of Russia, it would also reach all the way into Moscow and you know all of the major cities, basically in the western part of Russia. So these weapons essentially are designed for Russia and China.
Well, they would function against both, and they certainly will, and I'll come to Russia in a minute. But,
yeah.
you know, this is primarily against China. And
deployment, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's the intention of pulling out of the treaty anyway. And the intent here is not necessarily nuclear-tipped cruise missiles. So I want to make that clear. The treaty bans conventional delivery as well systems, as nuclear missiles, right. Because they're so interchangeable, and the possibility to detect whether a missile is not capable, of carrying a nuclear warhead where it is capable of carrying a conventional warhead, that was deemed impossible.
Yeah, you look at the cloud after the explosion. Was it a mushroom cloud or not, basically, yeah. Right?
But the treaty also bans launchers capable of firing a land-based missile intermediate right. range. And the reason for that is pretty obvious, because it's actually far harder to get a launch. It's far more dangerous to have a launcher already deployed within range of a country, and right. relatively easy to bring missiles in if it became necessary. Right. Right. So this is the interesting detail which the Western press is not widely reporting. The launch system that the U.S. used to launch this, to test this land-based intermediate-range Tomahawk cruise missile, was the MK-41 vertical launch system. It is basically the Aegis system. Now, the U.S. missile defense systems that are deployed in Eastern Europe are the Aegis Ashore system.
Right, Romania now, and in Poland, yeah. they're building it.
Now,
right?
yeah. on a ship, and I served in the U.S. Navy, so I've got some familiarity with these pieces, they are capable of firing both defensive SM-3 missiles, right, to right. intercept incoming missiles, aircraft, and so on, and offensive Tomahawk cruise missiles.
Right.
They can fire both.
Right.
And Russia has long complained, first of all, it was all upset about the missile, the pullout of the unilateral U.S. pullout of the ABM treaty to begin with. But yeah. for the last decade, Russia has complained loudly that these MK-41 launchers located in Romania and soon in Poland are under guise of a defensive missile system, are also offensive capable, and therefore a clear violation of the INF treaty, right?
Got it.
Because it bans the launchers as well.
Right.
And the U.S. response to this all along was first, it can't fire missile. It can't fire cruise missiles. And then when that didn't have any traction whatsoever, when enough people kind of went, actually it does, then it was, well, it doesn't have the software downloaded to fire these missiles.
Come on.
And we don't have any missiles right there right now, which, of course, has nothing to do with the treaty. It's a launcher capable of firing the missile.
Right.
So their only flimsy excuse was it doesn't have the software embedded, right?
Well, that would depend on who the vendor is, because some of them, you said, oh, it's Microsoft, to say, oh, well, never mind. Well, it'll be 10 years before it properly updates.
Of course, Russia regarded this excuse as just absurd.
Right.
And what it did is, under guise of anti-ballistic missile defense, it put a dual system also capable of firing land-based cruise missiles,
right.
which conventional or nuclear tipped, it could potentially be either, which have been within strike range of Russian Western cities, including Moscow and St. Petersburg, for almost a decade now. And right. Russia has always complained about this, and that it was the U.S. who was in violation of the treaty. Of course, the Western press ignored these accusations, and the Europeans also ignored them, and then went with the U.S. and Trump along with all of this, that it was Russia who was in violation of the treaty with this intermediate range cruise missile system that it also developed within the last couple of years. And I said from the beginning that I thought it was very possible that the Russian missile did violate the range, but that they were both in violation. And this is further proof of Russia's accusations all along, and that if Russia did develop an intermediate range cruise missile, land-based cruise missile, in violation of the treaty, it did it in direct response to the U.S. already having a system in place capable of firing the same.
Right.
Here I've got a tweet to demonstrate, this is from Matt Korda, who is a research associate nuclear information project at the Federation of American Scientists, who previously worked at NATO and King's College London. He taught in security studies. He tweeted this yesterday. The real kicker here is the MK-41 launcher. Russia has said for years that those deployed in Europe could launch Tomahawks and therefore violate the INF. U.S. denied it. 16 days after the INF treaty died, what does the U.S. do? Launch a Tomahawk from a ground-based MK-41 launcher.
Right. I mean, the U.S. Naval Institute says it appeared to be a Block 4 Tomahawk that was launched.
Yeah. So this is not coming from Russia here. This is coming from one of the U.S. owned scientists, formerly with NATO and everything.
Right.
So, you know, we got to call a big disinformation. And as far as the EU countries that for the last few months got in line behind Trump and Jens Stoltenberg saying that it was Russia in violation of the treaty and completely ignoring, you know, the Russian claims that, look, the U.S. has been putting these systems in violation of the INF in your countries for years. Right. You all these EU leaders, Jens Stoltenberg, NATO, you're lying bastards. That's all
right.
You are.
Yeah, right.
You are lying bastards. you know, Russia has been, you know, relatively quiet, you know, compared, you know, in their acknowledgement that the U.S. was in violation of their system in comparison to the fake news propaganda about Russia for the last few months. But as far as I'm concerned, this is pretty much proof positive that it was Russia once again who was being more honest, and right. was and it was the U.S. who violated the treaty at least first, all along.
And they were well positioned to do it. In other words, you had this very, very short time span between their announcement and the first firing.
So obvious about this and testing it right off the bat with the MK-41 launcher is basically a big middle finger up both towards the INF treaty and towards Russia.
You know, now what it shows me also, though, is that with these treaties, you know, you've got like a concrete wall somewhere where all these things that are prohibited are piled up, and it's like, okay, well, they're in lockdown right now. At the moment they come out of lockdown, though, we can just wheel them out and push the button. So in other words, when you think you're signing, you know, signing a treaty of security that, well, there's not going to be these weapon systems in development and production and deployment or whatever, now, these terms are not absolute. They're relative, and it means that, well, it's not in development. We developed it, but it's not in development. It's not in production. We produced them. They're over there, but they're not produced, and they're not deployed because we got them piled over here. If we move them to the other side of that hill over there, then they're deployed. And I mean, that's kind of the, you know, the space between compliance and non-compliance with some of these treaties.
Yeah, I mean, I've long said, I think I'm pretty sure I've said on your show before, that these treaties were, particularly this treaty, the INF treaty, was antiquated, right? It didn't, it never addressed sea and air-based, sea and air-launched cruise missiles, which with the U.S. as a maritime power and the Soviet Union as a land-based power, gave the U.S. an advantage with this treaty all along, such that actually Gorbachev's generals were horrified that he signed it. The Soviet generals were horrified with the advantage this gave the U.S. And Russia has long said, since the U.S. pulled out of the ABM back in 2003, that the INF treaty wasn't to Russia's national security interests. It was no longer, if it was ever, in Russia's national security interests. But they kept with it because of the fear that it would further unravel the New START treaty, which is due to expire. And if Trump is still in, well, right now, because these treaties these take years of prep work and negotiation. The fact that the U.S. refuses to sit down and even talk about an extension of the New START treaty now is pretty much a guarantee that even if he doesn't get reelected, that the New START treaty is dead. At least for a few years. And if once it expires, it's unlikely that whoever is president next time around in the U.S. will continue on with it, because obviously the U.S. National security state has lost interest in treaties that bind its hands, in terms of nuclear or conventional weapons. To me, this says, first of all, the U.S. claims that it was Russia that violated this treaty are wrong. It was them.
Right.
And not only did that, but it did not pull out of the treaty because of supposed Russian violations. It again pulled out because it wanted these missiles for use in the Pacific against China.
Right.
So that's two lies combined into one there. And this is just further proof of that duplicity.
So a couple things are demonstrated here about the changed condition from when this regime of arms controls, quote unquote, were first introduced or negotiated. One is that last fact. I mean, now suddenly they want these weapons against China because that's where the quote unquote threat is.
But we're not in a bilateral Cold War anymore.
Right. It's a different condition.
Bipolar world. We're in a world of great powers, and there are multiple powers.
Right. Right.
And China and India and the EU and all these others, they are not bound by these treaties that were signed between the U.S. and the Soviet Union and Russia as its legal successor.
So that's in terms of targets, other parties. Okay. Now also, though, in terms of geopolitics, you have the actual. See, there was something that was always really telling to me, and I didn't understand why people didn't talk about it all the time when they talked about the threat from the Soviet Union, which was that all of these different things assumed that World War III was going to be fought in Europe and Asia and not in the Western Hemisphere. In other words, the only scenario I ever saw outside of Red Dawn when we were invaded by Nicaragua was for World War III taking place in the Western Hemisphere was intermediate range ballistic missiles coming from Cuba in the midst of the Cuban Missile Crisis, and that was that. But otherwise, you look at the basing, where were all the troops faced, where's all the resources deployed, they're all targeting Russia and China, not the U.S. Russia and China can reach the U.S. with either, except for their new weapons, but submarine-based or land-based ICBMs, and bombers. And the U.S., though, has those things and all, the cruise missiles and everything else that were installed. There was not an analog cruise missile targeting Chicago, for example.
No.
Okay, and so now, we've got a shifting game board. Just recently, the things that are happening in Nicaragua and around Nicaragua, I'm sorry, Venezuela, for example, where, the Russian Navy will stop in and say hi to Venezuela. Who knows how things will get if it gets really heated on a global scale? Will we suddenly see intermediate range missiles in the Western Hemisphere targeting the United States, for example?
Well, even more than that, I think, to be honest, Russia simply doesn't have the military budget or the geopolitical horizon anymore to do more than symbolic spoiling with the U.S. in the Western Hemisphere. I don't think you're going to see Russian ships or missile systems or aircraft deployed in Venezuela or Cuba in any meaningful way like the U.S. can do all around Russia.
And there's also the contradiction that exists, a deep contradiction that exists in the so-called strategic partnership between Russia and China. But I'm not specifically trying to tag this on Russia. Somewhere in this rising multipolarity, there's going to be some sort of an attempt. There's got to be some sort of an attempt to address on a global chessboard the U.S. military's deployment targeting this rising multipolarity. And whether it's Russia, China, BRI forces, BRIC, whatever it ends up being, the real estate is, you know, in the places that are in play at the moment, you know, like Venezuela, Cuba, whatever.
But the other point of the antiquarian nature of this INF treaty, the other game changer, other than the new geopolitical multipolar great power system, is the technology. And that is where now threatens the U.S. territory, you know, continentally, territorially, not with Russian intermediate range systems deployed in the Western Hemisphere, which is beyond their budget and reach.
Right.
But they have developed these hypersonic, we've just had this
submarine drones and stuff,
Russia.
I know.
Right. Yeah, underwater drones. Russia just had this accident in the testing of the nuclear-powered cruise missile with a unlimited range and not firing at ballistic missile trajectory.
Whoa.
So nearly impossible to hit with anti-ballistic missiles. These are all technological advances that accomplish the same purpose asymmetrically and maintain what Russia desperately needs with a strategic deterrent, because Russia looks at the U.S. All around the world, that just by itself has a military budget more than 10 times what Russia has. The U.S. military budget is going up and Russia's military budget is going down. But then you have all the NATO allies, which also outspend, all the other non-U.S. NATO allies of the United States also outspend Russia by four times.
I mean, the Saudis, for example, who'd have thunk that, right?
They're outspending, buying almost exclusively from Western countries, military arms. Russia desperately, it regards its strategic deterrent and the viability of its strategic deterrent as absolutely necessary in the face of overwhelming U.S. and NATO conventional superiority, if just in numbers and budget now, and not simply weapon system on weapon system.
Right. Yeah. So that's a very sobering environment.
It should be, because we are in a new arms race. We have been for a while, but it becomes more and more obvious with each passing month, not even year at this point, but month. And you can be sure if the U.S. is already testing land-based cruise missiles, that Russia is doing the same. And even if the intention of both countries is, conventional, not nuclear, land-based cruise missiles for power projection, Russia would intention would probably be mostly intended for the Middle East, like it's been using the sea-based cruise missiles to great effect in Syria, and Russia's near abroad, but it's always the capability, and militaries plan for contingency, not just immediate need.
Right.
So both sides will at least be investing in, even if it's a limited amount of intermediate range nuclear missiles ready for deployment if the situation deteriorates as well. Russia has said that it will not deploy intermediate range missiles within range of Europe unless the U.S. does so and European countries allow them to put them there. And right now neither side has said that they intend to, but that situation can very quickly change, and now both sides will not be bound by that treaty and will have those missiles ready to deploy if the situation the political situation deteriorates further, and that should scare everybody.
The condition that we have now is that the U.S. considers itself no longer bound by the treaty, so whatever they would deploy in Europe, right at Russia's borders, they can have sitting on a dock waiting, to be airlifted, like whatever it is, 30 minutes, 5 hours, 2 days, whatever it takes. Boom, they're there. And
Russia could do the same even easier by deploying something, because Russia's such systems are usually mobile to begin with.
Right.
It's stationed in the Far East, They just put it on a train
right.
and send it towards the European border.
Yep.
that's the same equivalent. I mean, like I said, it doesn't immediately change the nuclear calculus, but it, once again, it increases, you know, it decreases the threshold for when these things could happen.
Yeah. Now we're looking at, we've only got a few minutes left, but we're looking at a condition where, of course, there are flashpoints where things could happen. Examples, what's going on right now, again, and with Turkey, Syria, and all of that, if you want to maybe take a quick hit at that.
Yeah, real quick. So I've long talked on the show about how for a couple years now, Russia and the Syrian government on one side, Turkey and the jihadists on the other, and the U.S. and their Kurdish allies and the SDF on the third side are in a three-way Mexican standoff in Syria, with both Turkey and the U.S. Occupying portions of Syria, with the Turkey occupying Syria's northwest and the U.S. occupying pretty much all of Syria's east and sitting on the oil as well. Turkey, and there's been this calculus where each is trying to maneuver the other two, or you know, one against the other. The Russia would like to see Turkey and the U.S. go to war. The U.S. would like to see Turkey and Russia go to war, and so on. But in recent days, Erdogan has once again been playing them off each other and basically threatening the U.S. that they would advance into U.S. and Kurdish-held territory in East Syria to set up what they call a peace zone, i.e. they would ethnically cleanse Kurds along the whole eastern length of the Turkish border with Syria as well, and replace them with Turkmen and Uyghurs and Sunni Islamists and so on. Turkey's project is to move all these people, including many of them displaced populations from Syria, who are, you know, in line with Turkey in this area once they've driven all the Kurds out. The U.S. has bucked and hemmed and hawed, and Turkey has threatened, and it's never happened yet. And once again, they've gone into some kind of talks about a joint patrol for this peace zone and so on. It hasn't gone anywhere. I don't expect it will. But this alone has really perturbed Russia, whose whole point here is to draw space between Turkey and the U.S., you know, rifts in NATO. I don't think it expects Turkey to pull out of NATO, but to create political difficulties between the two of them. And of course, it would much rather see them fight each other, and leaving only one enemy standing for Russia and the Syrian government to drive out of Syria. Right now, it's still got two. But recently, Russia and the Syrian government have been increasing their siege of Idlib province, which is in the hands of a Turkish, openly Turkish-backed al-Qaeda at this point. But al-Qaeda and their jihadist allies in Idlib keep launching attacks all around the outside of Idlib, which are almost completely unreported in the Western media, including against Russia's airbase in Maimim in Syria. Russia and the Syrian government have had enough, and they're finally seriously beginning a military campaign to retake Idlib in a serious way. And only in the past 2 weeks have we really seen movement. And we've seen it along a very standard new Russian military doctrine. One of the towns that's in range right now is Khan Shaykhun, which you may remember as this al-Qaeda-held town, which was the site of a supposed Syrian government chemical attack on al-Qaeda,
right.
Which the U.S. used as their excuse to launch the first missile attacks against Damascus under the Trump administration.
Right, that's right.
Russia and Syria are forming a cauldron around. They haven't quite completely closed it yet, but they're going to cut off Khan Shaykhun. The Turkish government, which has an observation post, i.e., you know, a redoubt in that area, was trying to resupply it with troops and tanks and so on. And it was stopped, whether it was the Russian Air Force or the Syrian Air Force with Russian approval. I tend to think it was the Russian Air Force. They bombed ahead of this convoy, killing some of the Turkish proxies, although the Turkish soldiers, and making the Turks turn tail and turn around, and making it clear that, you know, this operation to finally liberate Idlib from al-Qaeda is on, and the U.S., Russia is no longer going to accept Erdogan's excuses and stalling for time.
So we're going to watch this develop as we move along. Mark, thank you very much. We'll speak with you again later in the week.
Thanks for having me, Don.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.